Have you ever felt like you're chasing a moving target? You know, maybe you're in a new job and the goalposts seem to shift just as you get close.
Oh, definitely. Or like watching a stock price, maybe,
Yeah.
hoping it stays above some level, but that level itself keeps drifting up or down.
Exactly. Well, today we're diving into the math behind exactly that kind of thing, these really dynamic moving boundaries. So our mission for this deep dive is to explore something called passage times, specifically how random processes like that unpredictable stock market, or maybe the path of a tiny particle moving erratically, how they interact with boundaries that aren't fixed, boundaries that curve and change.
Well, we're digging into a brand new paper just out this June by Devar Khushnevisan and Chukyan Lee. It really pushes things forward, building on some foundational ideas in probability theory.
Yeah, it looks fascinating. So over the next little while, we'll try to unpack what these processes actually are, the really distinct ways they interact with these moving limits, and maybe why these seemingly abstract mathematical ideas have some pretty profound real-world implications.
Absolutely. We're talking connections to things like clinical trials, even understanding how stuff diffuses in, say, biological fluids.
Okay, so let's get started. Let's unpack this a bit. Before we get into the paper's really new findings, we need a couple of key ideas down. First off, what exactly is a self-similar Gaussian process? It sounds, well, pretty technical.
It does sound like a mouthful, yeah, but you can kind of break it down. First, Gaussian process. That just means if you look at this random thing over time, any snapshot, any collection of points follows that standard bell curve distribution, the normal distribution.
Okay, so it's random, but with a predictable statistical shape, like the bell curve.
Exactly. Now, the self-similar part is where it gets really interesting, I think. Imagine looking at a fractal pattern. You zoom in, you zoom out. You basically see the same kind of structure, right?
Right, the pattern repeats at different scales.
Well, a self-similar process is like that, but statistically speaking, if you stretch out the time axis and scale the magnitude in just the right way, the process looks statistically identical to how it started.
Huh. So randomness with a kind of built-in scaling rule.
Precisely. And that scaling behavior is captured by a single number, the self-similarity index, alpha. It's like the core characteristic of how its randomness scales with time.
Okay, got it. A random process Gaussian with this inherent scaling property alpha. So then what about the passage time itself? What are we actually measuring there?
Good question. So the passage time, which the paper calls TCT subscript C comma beta,
Yeah.
it's essentially asking, what's the first time T at or after time equals one that our random process, let's call it XT, crosses a specific moving boundary?
Okay, not a fixed line, but a moving one.
Exactly. And this boundary is defined by plus or minus t times t raised to the power of ec beta.
Right, c times t to the beta.
Yeah, so c is just a constant setting the sort of initial height or width of the boundary. And decay beta, that's the crucial one here, it dictates how quickly that boundary moves or curves over time. Is it accelerating away? Is it slowly expanding? That's beta.
So we're looking for the very first moment the process goes outside this moving fence.
That's it, the first escape time from a curved boundary.
Okay. And the paper really highlights three scenarios, doesn't it? Like, depending on how that process scaling, alpha, compares to the boundary scaling, beta, this is where it gets really interesting.
Exactly. It all boils down to the relationship between alpha and beta. These three cases cover everything. So, scenario one is what they call the supercritical case. This is when beta is greater than alpha. So the boundary grows or moves away faster than the process's natural scaling rate.
Faster boundary growth.
Right. And what's really counterintuitive here, maybe, is that there's a positive probability, a real chance, that the process never actually crosses the boundary.
Never. So it can just stay inside forever.
It can, with the non-zero probability, yes. Think of like a slow-moving cloud that's the process, and the horizon is just receding faster and faster. The cloud might just never reach it.
Wow. Okay. So if the boundary outpaces the process, escape isn't guaranteed. What about the other way around? If beta is less than alpha?
Ah, that's scenario two, the subcritical case. Here, beta is less than alpha, so the boundary grows slower than the process's self-similarity index suggests it should spread.
Okay, slower boundary.
In this case, it's the opposite. The process is guaranteed to cross the boundary. It always crosses, eventually. And importantly, it does so in a kind of statistically well-behaved way.
Well-behaved meaning.
Meaning we can calculate things like the average time it takes to cross, the variance of that time, even higher statistical moments, and they're all finite. They're predictable quantities.
So crossing is certain, and we can actually say something meaningful about when it's likely to happen.
Exactly. Like a fast river hitting a slowly receding bank. It's definitely going to overflow, and pretty predictably, too.
Okay, super critical. Might never cross. Subcritical, yeah, always crosses predictably. That leaves the knife edge case, right? When beta equals alpha.
Right. Scenario 3, the critical case. Beta equals alpha. This is where things get, well, critical. And mathematically, it's the most intricate.
What happens here, then?
So in this critical case, the paper introduces a really important function. It's called the critical boundary crossing exponent, and noted lambda of c.
Lambda of c. Okay, what does that tell us?
Lambda of c essentially acts as a threshold for the moments of the passage time. Remember how in the subcritical case, all moments were finite?
Yeah.
Well, here in the critical case, it depends. The expected value of the passage time raised to some power, say, mu, etc., is finite only if that power of c is less than this critical exponent phi.
Ah, okay. So lambda of c sets the limit on how much statistical information we can reliably get.
Precisely. If e is greater than there, then that expected value that moment becomes infinite. It blows up. You can't predict it reliably.
And how does this lambda behave? Does it depend on that boundary height c?
It does, very much so. Lambda is not increasing as c increases. So a higher boundary makes crossing less likely, and lambda gets smaller, meaning fewer moments are finite. It's also convex and continuous. And crucially, it tends to zero as c gets very large.
So for really high boundaries in critical case, even the average crossing time might be infinite.
Potentially, yes.
Right.
It suggests crossing becomes very hard to pin down. Conversely, if c is small, lambda is large, and many moments are finite. The paper also mentions a technical condition, strong local non-determinism, or SLND.
SLND?
Yes, it's a property ensuring the process is sufficiently random locally. When a process satisfies SLND, this lambda function behaves even more nicely. It's strictly positive, strictly decreasing, and goes to infinity as c goes to zero.
Okay, so this critical case is this really delicate balance quantified by this lambda exponent, which itself depends on the boundary height and this SLND property.
Exactly. It's a much richer picture than just always crosses or might never cross.
So stepping back a bit, this isn't just an isolated result, is it? You mentioned it builds on earlier work. How does this fit into the bigger picture of probability theory?
That's a really important point. This work by Kausch, Nevison, and Lee is a major generalization of a really famous result in probability theorem of Brayman and Shep from way back in 1967.
Brayman and Shep. Okay. What did they show?
Their theorem focused on a very specific canonical case, standard Brownian motion, which is a Gaussian process with self-similarity index alpha equals 12. And they looked at it crossing a critical square root boundary, which means beta was also 12.
Ah, so they nailed the critical case for the most standard process and a specific boundary shape.
Exactly. And what Kausch, Nevison, and Lee have done is take that core idea and blow it wide open. They've extended it beyond just Brownian motion to this whole class of self-similar Gaussian processes, and crucially, beyond that specific square root boundary to these general curved boundaries defined by any beta.
That sounds like a pretty significant extension.
It really is. And it connects to other deep areas, too. For instance, understanding these passage times is fundamental in martingale theory. Things like the Burkholder-Davis-Gundy inequality, which is crucial for understanding the size of martingales, mm-hmm. are related. It also helps in the analysis of slow points in random processes, those rare times a process might linger or move unusually slowly.
And you mentioned real-world connections earlier, like clinical trials. How does that fit in?
Right. The clinical trials link is fascinating. For a particular process called fractional Brownian motion, which we'll probably get to the super and subcritical cases, beta greater than alpha, beta less than alpha, actually mirror some recent ideas for analyzing clinical trial data.
How so?
Well, imagine you're testing a drug. You're tracking patient recovery, maybe, against some threshold that represents a meaningful improvement over time, that's your boundary. Now, if the expected treatment effect, which might have its own scaling property, grows faster than the inherent variability or self-similarity of patient responses.
The supercritical case, beta greater than alpha.
Exactly. Then this theory tells us there's a real chance the trial might never show a statistically significant effect crossing that boundary, even if the drug has some positive impact. It might just not be enough to outpace the boundary defined by the trial's criteria and the noise.
So understanding this could tell researchers, look, based on early data, this trial might be in a supercritical regime. Continuing it indefinitely might be futile.
Precisely. It could guide decisions about trial design, duration, or maybe even redefining the boundary or endpoint. It offers a mathematical basis for making those tough calls.
That's a powerful application. Okay, so you mentioned fractional Brownian motion. Can you give us a few more concrete examples of these self-similar Gaussian processes where these results actually apply?
Absolutely. Fractional Brownian motion, FBM, is probably the most famous example after standard Brownian motion. It's H self-similar, so its alpha index is just H, the Hurst parameter. And importantly, it satisfies that SLND condition we mentioned.
Okay, and FBMAT models.
Well, when H12, it is standard Brownian motion classic diffusion, like pollen grains of water. But if H is different from 12, it models anomalous diffusion. If H12, the process has long-range dependence, it's more persistent. If H12, it's anti-persistent.
And where do we see that?
Oh, all over the place. From molecule movement in crowded biological cells to modeling volatility in financial markets, hydrology, network traffic. It's a really versatile model.
Yeah.
And the key thing is the paper's main results, theorem 1.1 and corollary 1.2, apply directly to FBM for any H between 0 and 1.
So finance, biology, okay. Any other examples?
Yes. Another important class arises from solutions to certain linear stochastic partial differential equations, SPDEs. These are equations that describe phenomena evolving randomly in both space and time. Think about heat diffusing randomly or a surface growing randomly.
Yes, PDEs, right, more complex systems.
Definitely. And the work, for instance, by Mueller and Wu show that solutions to certain SPDEs, often involving operators like the fractional Laplacian, can indeed be self-similar Gaussian fields or processes. And again, under certain conditions on the equation's parameters, things related to the spatial dimension, the differential operator, the noise structure, these solutions also satisfy the SLND condition.
So the passage time results apply there too.
They do. The self-similarity index alpha in these cases is often determined by a combination of the parameters of the SPDE, like the dimension nu, and exponents of beta and gamma related to the operator and the noise. It really shows how these mathematical ideas connect different fields.
It's amazing how the same core mathematical structure appears in such different contexts. Okay, so even with such a big step forward, research never stops. Does the paper point towards any unanswered questions or directions for future work?
Oh, absolutely. Good research always opens new doors. The authors explicitly mention a few open problems. For instance, remember the critical exponent?
Yeah, the threshold for finite moments.
Right. There's another related function, Z1C, which is known to equal C for standard Brownian motion, or for 12. But they ask, is always equal to Z1C for any 12 self-similar Gaussian process satisfying SLND? That's still open. It hints at potentially deeper connections.
Interesting. What else?
Well, confirming the validity of that SLND condition for certain SPDEs, specifically when a parameter is zero, is still listed as an open problem. Pinning that down would solidify the application of the critical exponent theory in those cases.
Okay.
They also explored the relationship between the critical exponent lambda for SPDE solutions, let's call it SX, and the one for fractional Brownian motion, EB. They made some comparisons, but left open the precise nature of that relationship, a comparison of critical exponents.
So how do these different kinds of randomness compare at the critical boundary?
Sort of, yeah. And finally, there's a very practical point. Actually simulating these boundary crossing exponents efficiently. Calculating them precisely is hard. Monte Carlo methods can be used, but they're often slow and computationally intensive. Finding faster, more accurate simulation techniques is a real computational challenge.
Right, making the theory more practically usable. Okay, so today we've journeyed into this really intricate world of random processes and their dynamic curved boundaries, from, you know, the microscopic dance of particles to the sophisticated models used in clinical trials. Understanding these passage times seems pretty critical for predicting when and how a system crosses some moving threshold.
It really does. It's about finding structure in randomness when faced with changing limits.
And I think what really stands out is how this delicate balance between the process's own inherent scaling, its self-similarity alpha, and the way its boundary curves, that beta exponent determines everything. Whether it's guaranteed to escape, might never escape, or exists in that finely tuned critical state described by lambda.
It's a beautiful interplay between the process and its environment, mathematically speaking.
Definitely. So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's something to maybe think about. Consider the boundaries you encounter in your own life. You know, personal goals, professional targets, maybe even societal norms. How many are truly fixed lines? And how many are more like these curved boundaries constantly shifting?
That's a great thought. Things rarely stand still.
And if you had to guess your own self-similarity index, your own way of adapting or persisting, how do you think you navigate those ever-changing limits? Something to ponder.